The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
On today's show, we are going to handle a couple of email questions from listeners. We've got a question on earthquake insurance. This is a new one for the show. And we also have a life insurance question. So we don't talk super extensively about insurance here on the show. We mix it up with lots of different topics, but today is going to be fairly heavily monopolized, if you will, by insurance questions, but we answer them as we get them. So we just happen to have a flurry. I don't know if you can call two a flurry, but two in a row happen to be insurance questions. So welcome to today's show. I'm here with Jim. My name's Chris, and this is actually the first episode of our somewhat new format, as we're going to transition this month to some exciting new things on the Retirement and IRA Show. Jim, do you want to fill in what your vision is for the next month?
The first thing was to break out the Colorado aspect of the show and go back to just terrestrial radio, terrestrial radio, so to speak, with KFKA. So the first thing is we're back to 1 hour on landlocked radio here in Northern Colorado. This doesn't have anything to do with our iTunians. I don't even know if we'll have that show available on iTunes. I haven't quite decided yet. And that radio show is going to be more Colorado specific. We're going to get into more, because we kind of strayed away from that as our iTunes podcast grew in popularity. So we weren't talking about PARA, the Colorado Retirement Plan, anymore. We weren't talking much about WEP and GPO, how it tied into PARA. We weren't talking about tax issues in the state of Colorado. We didn't get into how the first $20,000 of pension and Social Security money in Colorado is not taxed, and all these other different unique Colorado issues. So the radio show has gone back to landline terrestrial and 1 hour in length, giving us more opportunity on this podcast to make it geared more towards our iTunians. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want to do. Now, it kind of has blindsided us. September just came out of nowhere.
It's pretty much here.
It is here. Today is August something, but I think, what, 28th,
29th? We're recording this on the 28th.
28th.
This will play or be released on the... Actually, we don't have to stick to our old schedule. So this will be playing the beginning of September, on the first day or two of September.
Julia intends to release the show probably every Saturday. still. She wants to stay on that.
So this will be released that the timeline. 2nd of September.
That's what she's hoping, to make them available on iTunes every Saturday, although a request was put in, and we're contemplating releasing one every Wednesday and one every Saturday. That was Andrew's suggestion in the office.
Like, do two a week?
Well, this is when
now
we...
Now you're starting to scare me, Jim.
Yes, sorry about that. I didn't tell you that part. This is when we were thinking of putting the KFKA show on iTunes as well. But I'm leaning towards not putting it on there, mostly because it would only really interest Colorado listeners. And I think we...
Well, some people in Colorado are on iTunes.
So we may still put that show on iTunes. And that would come out on a different day than the Retirement and IRA show. I think the big thing that we want our iTunians to know, we have, yes, big changes on our terrestrial radio show, but even, I think, as big changes for our iTunians. And that is, we will be broadcasting this. Chris is finally, you've downloaded the software, you're testing it. And the good news is, you won't have to be on Facebook to hear us live, which is good for yours truly, because I'm not on Facebook. I don't even know how to use it. What if someday I want to listen to you?
You could be taught. It's not too hard.
Oh, I've gone this far in my
life.
Your
mom is probably on Facebook. If she can figure it out, you can probably figure it out,
Jim. But there's no... Give me 27 good reasons why I need to be on Facebook.
I'll give you one, so you could listen to the Retirement and IRA show.
Life.
Had that been where we decided to put it. But I think we're going to make it more generic.
It is generic.
Where there will probably be a link to it on our Facebook page. Jim Saulnier & Associates does have its own Facebook page. So if you're following that, you'll get updates about the... live broadcast of the, I guess we shouldn't call it the radio show anymore, but live podcast that we'll be doing that'll also be available shortly after it's live broadcast or live streamed for replay purposes. It's not immediate. We have to get jump through a couple of hoops after we stream it live in order to be able to repost it. So there'll be a slight delay there, but it shouldn't be too bad. And we decided instead of sticking it only on Facebook, we'd make it a little more generally available. So you'll be able to stream it from a variety of apps that we'll tell you about. You can stream it directly from the website, our the retirementandiraShow.com website. We'll probably put it up on jimhelps.com as well, because a lot of people know that website. And then there's mobile apps. You can listen on your tablet or your phone. So there's all kinds of stuff you can do. And we're trying to build it all so that you can call in live and or even chat with us as far as typing it in. If that's, what do you mean no? It's built into that software we have.
Well, compliance doesn't like text. Everything, you know, everything we write has to be retained for SEC purposes.
We're not going to write it.
Anything we chat. You said you chat. Chatting is not...
Well, they write us the question.
We'll ask compliance. We'll ask. If they want to send us a written question, that might be okay.
It's the same as an email question.
But emails are retained. Emails are retained. Every email that comes to me, compliance can read.
But we, like today, we're going to answer a couple email questions.
Correct. So if people want to send us emails when we're live broadcasting, that would be no problem. I can't guarantee you that
chat. May not be able to do the chat feature.
Chat feature. Okay. Compliance may have an issue with that because the SEC mandates everything sent to us in writing has to be retained for 5 years.
So Jim will, we'll just force Jim to check his email regularly during the show.
On my iPad, which I can do.
Well, you mean your easel?
Right now it's working as an easel because I did print out these emails. But look, I can move these pieces of paper, click this button, and get into my email.
Is it working now?
Well, no, I didn't turn
it
on.
Thinking? Oh, I thought it was still spinning. The wheel of delay.
The wheel of delay... yeah, see, it's still spinning right next to my little thing right there.
I guess we'll address that later.
Doesn't work when the email's down.
So lots of so interesting evolutionary items are going to be happening this month.
The big change is going to be listeners, hopefully by the first week in October. This is my deadline in-house. Whether or not we can pull this off, I don't know, but I think we can. And it'll still be Monday afternoon we're recording for your semester?
Yes.
Okay. So what it'll be is every Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock Mountain Time, you will be able to stream the Retirement and IRA show and listen to us as we record the show. And the reason we wanted to go this route is it will allow people to actually call us while we're recording and talk to us and have their questions answered. Now, emails will still be available throughout the week, just like the two we received. One sent it directly to jim@jimhelps.com. And the other was actually on our radio show website and sent it to us through the form on the website, Contact Jim and Chris Now. Either way, you can go to jimhelps.com, J-I-M-H-E-L-P-S.com, and you can send us an email right there. Right on the homepage is a Contact Us button. Or you can just email us jim@jimhelps.com. That will still be available. Send us an email. We'll answer the question. But beginning hopefully within another 4 or 5 weeks, by hopefully by October 1st, although that first weekend in October, I think I'm out elk hunting. So it might be you and Junior on the first live broadcast.
Okay.
Or not. But I'm leaving, I think, the 6th. That first weekend, okay. I'm going to be out trying to fill
maybe
my freezer.
Maybe we could live stream from the hunt.
Be very quiet.
So Jim is lining it up right now. Kind of like golf talk. Right?
But yeah, I think that first weekend I'm elk hunting on the West Slope, so I may not be able to. That may be a recorded show as well.
Okay.
So maybe the second week of October should be our kickoff. But what we envision, what we hope, folks, is our iTunian listeners will be able to call us up and get their questions answered and chat with Chris and I. And whenever Junior is in, or Pete, or Brandon, any of the guests we regularly have, you can reach out and chat with them as well and get your questions answered. So we're trying to take the Retirement and IRA show more to a more active Q&A format and teach people all about retirement. We're not going to give you hot stock tips. We never have on this show. We intend to answer your questions, and we intend to teach you a lot of the little nuances of retirement planning that people just don't quite understand. And that's what we want to be able to do. So from Social Security questions all the way up to IRA distribution questions, we'll be here to answer them in a more live format, entertaining. The show itself today, we have no idea how long this show is going to be. Could be 20 minutes or it could be 2 hours. Depends how deep you and I want to get on answering these two email questions. So that, I think, is another unique thing our iTunians will notice. It's not going to follow a set time frame. There's no scheduled breaks. Whenever Chris and I decide we need to go grab some water or go use the facilities or just take a break, or if I have to handle something in the office, we'll play a little message to everyone. And during that message play, Chris and I will be taking a quick little break, and then we'll come back. That's how we're envisioning this podcast running. So does that all kind of explain it all out to our listeners, you think?
That's more than enough.
All right.
Time for an email.
So we beat that horse to... No.
Nope.
The horse is already dead and we beat it too much. So time to move on. This first email did come in. So Sunday the 27th.
That was yesterday for us.
Oh, goodness. That's right. It was yesterday.
Hot off the presses.
Seems so much longer. But, okay. So he lives in Texas and we have a...
Already have a star in Texas.
Oh, no. He doesn't live in Texas. Never mind.
Have you read the email?
I did. I saw Texas again, so I thought he lived in Texas. You know what we're going to have to do is mandate, though, people tell us what state they're in.
Otherwise, they get no answer.
Well, we got two more emails today with no
states.
Hold
their question hostage until they supply the required information? That seems a little harsh.
Well, I still haven't got the new email, not the new email, the same email from my New Hampshire listener.
They stopped listening.
I think he's mad because I lost his email.
I would be.
All right. So this one came in. I have a feeling he's from California, but I'm not sure. It's fairly straightforward. This is not going to take a very long time for me to answer, which is very rare here on the Retirement
True.
And IRA Show.
I'll believe it when I hear it.
Well, it begins. In light of the disaster in Texas, and I will say, what a terrible disaster that is going
bad,
on
yeah,
down there.
Still going on, even.
I know. We have a couple of Texas iTunians. We'll have to reach out to them and see how they're doing because there's Lone Star George.
Yeah.
I don't know where in Texas he is.
Big state, so hopefully he's way away from Houston.
Hopefully he's way away. But we have a few people in Texas. We'll have to reach out to them. But it begins. In light of the disaster in Texas, I have a question regarding event-specific insurance. In my case, it would be earthquake insurance. I've never had it before, but now that I have about $200,000 equity in my primary residence, should I get it? It costs $646 a year in premiums, and that seems high, considering there is a $60,000 deductible. What do you think? And he signs it with his real name, but he also put, I mean, George. So we're going to call him George, as we always do. We're not going to call him his real name. The one thing I don't know, Chris, he said the premium is $646. He didn't say annually. I threw that part in. That could be monthly. But I would assume.
Well, the problem, he told us how much equity he has. He didn't tell us the value of the property, so it's hard to know if that's, if he's got $200,000 equity on a $1.5 million house, that's a little different story than $200,000 on a $400,000 house. So,
but what I wanted to point out to him, the amount of equity in his home is immaterial.
Well, I can see where he's saying that, you know, if things go, then he's going to walk away from the mortgage, which has its own hazard.
That's something totally different.
That's a whole different kind of question.
That's something totally different. If he was, but even if he, a lot of mortgage places will probably require you to have this insurance.
His question implies that his mortgage that he's got
is paid off. Or the mortgage carrier is going to require it. When I lived in the foothills, State Farm required me to have certain level of coverage because of fires. And they actually came to my house and inspected it to make sure I cut everything free.
Yeah, but there's areas where you might be close enough or within a certain type of floodplain where you could get flood insurance, for instance, but it's not, the threat isn't high enough or the probability is high enough for the mortgage company to require it. And maybe that's where he's falling. Certainly, if you're in an area that's prone to earthquakes, the mortgage company may very well require that you have earthquake coverage as a stipulation for having the mortgage. Doesn't sound like that's the case because he doesn't have it.
Doesn't have it now.
And since he quoted his equity rather than the value of the house, I can't imagine, people wouldn't normally talk like that. They wouldn't say, I now have $200,000 of equity in the house. They would say, my house is $400,000 and it's paid off. They wouldn't. So I think he's got a mortgage on the thing the way he talks.
And he's trying to just protect
the $200,000
of equity.
And he's somewhere where he doesn't have earthquake insurance, so he must not be in a place that's so prone that the mortgage company is requiring it, but he's in an area that does offer it. A lot of times unless it's a certain chance in your area, they won't even offer certain types of coverage, and you can't necessarily get earthquake insurance in, I don't know, what's a state with absolutely no earthquakes? Iowa, right? That might not even be offered in Iowa. I don't know for a fact. I haven't checked it, but the fact that he's worried about it, my guess is it is West Coast, probably California, where he's having this question. So say he has an earthquake without the coverage, the earthquake insurance coverage. Who's really on the hook for at least the loan part? Mortgage company.
Yeah, right? But he's
now, they're going to go after him unless he's got the coverage. Just because the mortgage holder owns, well, in air quotes, half your house and you have the other $200,000 of equity, the mortgage company's not going to be happy if the house is completely destroyed. You still owe them that money.
But
it
also,
doesn't just go away when you have
an
earthquake.
No, it doesn't go away, but it also doesn't mean if he got the earthquake insurance and he just wants to protect his $200,000 of equity, the insurance company is going to just cut him a check for $200,000 or his minus the $60,000 deductible. When I filed two claims a few years ago with State Farm, the check is actually made out to me and the mortgage company.
Absolutely.
And they get their cut.
Yes.
I couldn't go cash that. I had to go to Chase Bank because my mortgage was with Chase Bank, and they were disclosed that issue had happened. I had to prove that the issue was fixed, and there's a lot of things I had to go through to get that check cashed.
I guess there's two main questions here. The mechanics of his particular situation, exactly what he's got. And he didn't give us all the details. So he needs to fully understand the position he's in relationship to his mortgage holder and his equity and the exact coverage, whether it's monthly or yearly. That sounds like an extreme monthly number, but if his house is worth enough, it might very well be that. he needs to fully understand that before he can make a decision. And then there's the more, I guess, basic question, what type of risk should I insure versus just hope for the best? Right? Because I think that's the crux of his question.
That's the crux of
his
question.
He's not asking us how earthquake insurance works, but I would encourage him to make sure to ask that of someone who can clearly explain how the policy he's looking at works, how his mortgage holder also is part of that whole conversation. But then the basic, I guess, last sentence maybe, should he get the insurance based on the numbers he gave to us?
And that's the thing I do. He also wanted to know, should he have this event-specific insurance? I'm not going to say yay or nay. I'm going to say it needs to be discussed with your carrier. And I'm not trying to take a wussy way out of this and just say, I don't know. It's a decision he needs to make. When I lived in the fire-prone area up in the foothills, mm-hmm. where fires can rip through, and the year I moved that massive fire, the 107-square-mile fire in northern Colorado in 2012, got to 2 miles of my house, which still sounds like far away. Let me tell you, for a forest fire, that's damn close.
Mm-hmm.
And it stopped 2 miles from my house. But I'm glad when that fire was raging, I had the coverage. One of the things I can tell you is the minute, and this applies to any event-specific, not just earthquake insurance, the minute that fire started, you couldn't get homeowners insurance. You couldn't get the coverage. It was too late. No one was selling it. Because I was talking to Chip Beek, my agent, about it because I had been evacuated, and I went down to the State Farm office and needed to get the information, because they were paying for my hotel. I had
Mm-hmm.
And that was an option I bought. Mm-hmm. So they paid for me to go stay at a hotel for the 10 days I was evacuated for, seven to 10 days. I forget how long I was evacuated for. And he was just telling me, we were chatting about it, and he was saying, yeah, you know, he says, people are calling trying to get coverage, and it's too late. You can't get it when the fire has started and is moving your way. You can't up your coverage. You can't get the coverage. So anyone considering any type of event-specific insurance, it's too late to get flood insurance in Texas.
When you see the storm heading your way.
Yes, or when the water's moving down the river, you can't call up and get it. It's too late. No one's going to sell it to you. He has to make a decision. Yeah, there's many things you alluded to. Could he just, if there's no equity in the house, did he need it? Because he could just walk away. And yeah, that would create a whole host of financial issues. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you have no equity in the house, mm-hmm. it's just, well, no, I'm going to default on this mortgage. I'm done. Take the house. Some people do that. Mm-hmm. But if you do build up a lot of equity in the house, do you want to protect it? Do you want to be able to rebuild that home? And that's, to me, a personal decision. I happen to have made that decision when I lived in the fire-prone area. Now, if I lived in a floodplain, when we had that big flood in Colorado 5 years ago, nothing compared to what's in Houston, mind you. But for Colorado, it was a major flood. My house is rather high. I live up on a hill. I mean, it's high. If water is reaching me, there's an arc coming across somewhere with every animal on it. But in the lower areas, about 2 miles from me, they flooded, mm-hmm. and I drive by their house all the time. And they're definitely low, and then you climb out of that up to my house higher up on a hill. And I hope they had the flood insurance. They were only a few miles down the road. But I know that I bring this up only because as I was looking at some homes, the realtor would say to me, this is a floodplain. You're going to need the flood insurance here. In fact, one house I looked at, the man had lived in it since the 1970s. He built the house, and he was giving me the tour, and he told me I should get flood insurance, that this is the floodplain, his house, and that he built it up a little higher, and he encouraged me to make sure to get it. The thing is, when that flood came, I went by his house. You couldn't get to it because the bridge had flooded out. But I walked to it. My girlfriend and I at the time, we hiked down to it. And it was flooded. The whole yacht, his house looked like an island because of the way he raised it. And his neighbor's house had flooded right into the house. But his house, the way he had built it up, it was surrounded by water. It looked like he had oceanfront property. And it stayed there for a few days until it went away, the water receded. But for Colorado, they tell you the flood zones you're in and if you need the flood insurance or not based on where you live, and that was one area that you would need it. So I think he needs to decide. We can't tell him. I don't even know what state he lives in. Again, if he's somewhere where earthquakes are very, very rare, he may want to think twice if it's even available. But I'm guessing he's in the West Coast, California, Oregon, and he needs to decide what would cause more damage. Walking away, eating a big loss and repairing it, or buying the coverage. Mm-hmm. He has to decide that. I've spent $650, I don't know if that's monthly or annually, on worse things.
I think when people are mulling this over and weighing, imagine for a moment that it happens. If you would be completely devastated because you don't have a lot of other financial resources, that's a little different story than, yes, it will harm me. Nobody wants to give up a couple $100,000, but if their life won't be changed tremendously by that, then that's a completely different story than someone who will be absolutely financially devastated. So if you can't afford, same thing goes with cars. Even if you don't have a loan on the car, if you have a loan, of course, they're going to require you have full coverage. But once you don't, then the question is, do I want to have full coverage or not? It's a lot more expensive. Some people are fine going without it because they know, yes, it would be unfortunate if the car gets destroyed, but I could handle that financially. It would be a little stressful, it'd be a bummer if it happened, versus someone who would be completely devastated and would have no car then for the next 6 months or something like that as they tried to recover. Those are two completely different circumstances, and depending on where you are in that spectrum will help answer, I think, for you how you should proceed as far as the insurance goes. If an earthquake can happen where you are, and it's not, certainly they don't happen every day, but if it's a thing that happens in your area, if you would be completely devastated, like most of your net worth is in that $200,000 that you've got, I would tend to say, think about it far more seriously than, it's nice that I have equity, I want to protect it, I want to protect my Mercedes-Benz or whatever, but if something happens to it, I'll cry for a day or two, but then I could get over it. See where you are between those two things.
But I would say, and this gets beyond our level of expertise because we're not property casualty insurers, he should definitely talk to someone very knowledgeable mm-hmm. in earthquake policies to make sure he understands the nuances, and I'm sure there's going to be a ton of them.
Yep.
The nuances of that policy. They don't work as flood insurance is the same way. It's not as straight, oh, I have flood insurance, I'm covered. There's limits, there's deductibles, there's all sorts of things.
My parents had to go through that whole process down in Texas, not in Houston, but in Austin. And I learned, unfortunately, more about flood insurance details than I ever wanted to know. And it was far more complicated than I imagined as far as the structure insurance, the contents insurance, how that plays together. It was shocking to me that it was as convoluted as it was.
And I'm just assuming earthquake insurance
probably
is going to
be
the same. Mm-hmm. And the other thing with insurance, I want this listener to know, and all listeners, you want it when you need it. And there's no other way of putting it. When I came home that day, November of 2015 now, I think it was, I told you I came home and I heard water running. It was when I was renovating the house. And I thought, oh, they hooked up the kitchen sink finally and left the faucet running because I heard running water when I walked in. And I just thought that's what it was. And I walked into the kitchen and there weren't no water running. There wasn't no sink either. Still wasn't in. And I was like, huh, I wonder what that running water is. And I turned around and it was water pouring out of my roof into my living room because the swamp cooler had burst. And it was at that point, the first thing that ran through my mind was first call my mom. I think I told you that. I ended up calling her before the insurance company. And the second thing was, I'm glad I have insurance. I mean, because I knew this is an insurance claim. There's water everywhere and ceiling everywhere because it had caved in. And I was just glad I had insurance. Prior to that, was I ecstatic about paying insurance premiums? No. But I was at that moment. And same thing when the tornado hit right down my road, about a mile away from me. But although I didn't get the tornado, I got a ton of hail, and it caused damage on my roof. Once again, I was glad I had insurance. State Farm weren't too glad because I filed two claims in less than a year.
Yeah, for sure.
And we thought they were going to cancel me. But one of them at least was beyond my control. I kind of muffed up on the swamp cooler. But the hail, I mean, that was nature or the Lord, depending on your beliefs, that dumped hail all over me. I had no control over that. But State Farm was none too pleased when I filed that claim.
For sure.
First one was bad enough. So I really enjoyed having it, or felt much more comfortable having it. And that's something that he's going to have to take into account. If he's worried, I'd get it. But it's a decision he needs to make and talk with his property casualty insurer, find out the true cost, find out the ifs, ands, and buts, nuances of the policy. But anybody, if you live in one of these areas, you hope you never need it, but you are glad you have it when you do. And it is too late to get it when the earth is shaking, the fire is coming, or the flood is upstream headed your way. You can't get the coverage then. And you really have to decide if it's worth it to you to protect not only, and it's not only his equity, a good homeowner's. Well, I'm sure a homeowner's policy, would it cover the property inside your house, your goods in an earthquake? Or do you need earthquake insurance to cover your stuff inside? That I don't know. This is something else he needs to think of. I know on the flood, there were two parts. How much they were going to fix on the damage, but then my property was under something separate.
Correct.
And they limited that. I wonder if you had an earthquake and you don't have earthquake coverage and they don't cover your house, are they going to cover your property at least? Or do you need earthquake coverage for that? Something else he needs to think of. For even those people without equity in their homes, and they think, well, I'll just walk away. Well, you might walk away with none of your stuff, right, which could still add up to $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll wrap this question. And actually, this is a good time for a quick break. So we're going to take a quick break here. Be short for you, only about a minute. So we'll be back with you with question number two here on the Retirement and IRA Show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
On the good ship, lollipop, it's a sweet trip to a candy shop where bonbons play. On the sunny beach in Peppermint Bay, lemonade.
Well, welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. If you enjoyed that quick break, wasn't real long. That is a song from 1935 as we look back to the year that Social Security started. That is a very recognizable song, of course, On the Good Ship Lollipop, sung by a six-year-old Shirley Temple. Song actually was released in 1934, but was still very, very popular in 1935. Here's a fun fact. Shirley Temple was allowed to choreograph her dance movements during the scene in Bright Eyes, the movie where she sang this song. That was quite a lot of responsibility for a six-year-old. Yeah, so not singer, dancer.
Choreographer.
Wow. Choreographer, yeah. So, why do we look back to this? We look back on this.
You forgot?
Social Security. Because every week we try to do an update on our other blog. Is this a blog? I guess it's not an
this
other
This is
blog.
A podcast.
So we have a podcast, and we have a blog.
But the blog is also on iTunes. It's a audio and written blog.
So it's a blogcast?
The blogcast, yeah.
Something like that. Anyway, we have a blog where we talk about Social Security items, so we'd like to give you an update there. So let's look at that.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
So this week on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, that is the address for our blog, if you haven't seen it before, is we received a question, actually, from a listener asking us what they could do. They had filed for Social Security, but then got another job and didn't need the Social Security and would like to suspend their benefits. Turns out, in their case, they were told by the Social Security Administration they were not able to suspend their benefits. So he was reaching out to find out, was there anything at all he could do, because he wanted to take advantage of higher Social Security benefit payments that you receive by delaying claiming. And he initially thought he was going to have to file early. He did so, then ended up getting a new job. So we talk about withdrawing your application, actually, in this answer. I won't give you all the details, but while it was not possible for him to suspend his benefits, mainly because he had not yet reached his full retirement age, he is able, with constraints, to withdraw his application for benefits. Now, there's a big gotcha in that. In order to successfully withdraw your application, you must pay back all benefits that have been paid to you since you filed. So it isn't necessarily practical for everyone. You would have to have other financial resources in order to pull that off, and you'd have to weigh the benefits and costs to doing that versus just leaving it as it is and writing it out. So that was the topic on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com this week. You can listen to it right now. It's posted online as we speak.
Excellent.
What's new, pussycat?
Okay, this is our last question for this episode of the Retirement and IRA Show. So sit back. We got another 4 hours.
The first one was supposed to be the short one. So
I know.
It kind of strung out a little. But you did waste like 13 minutes talking about the format of the new show.
13 minutes it took?
Yes.
Time flies when I'm having fun.
13 full minutes.
Wow. iTunians are going to be ticked off on that one.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys, but now you all know about the change, so we won't have to talk about it in the future. So that'll save that 13
Perfect.
Minutes. Okay. But in case no one remembered, the new format.
Oh, please.
You'd be able to call. See, if this person called in, we could have skipped all that.
True.
Okay. Again, I have no idea where this gentleman is from.
By the way, when you send us an email, we would really appreciate it if you indicated where you're from, because I have this really beautiful color map that we're trying to mark with a star on the state every time we receive our first question from that state. And we have over half the states covered, trying to do the whole thing. I'm not sure what kind of celebration we're going to have when we put that final star on. I suspect Idaho is going to be the last state, but I don't
know. So someone from Idaho, he's calling you out.
I've been to Idaho. They're worried about lots of other stuff other than listening to the radio.
Okay, well, if somebody emails you from Idaho,
then I will apologize and happily place a star on the map.
You know, when we had an iTunian out not too long ago for the eclipse, mm-hmm. and they stopped in to see the office, and
Did he ask to see the map?
Well, he came to the recording studio. Mm-hmm. I showed it, and he saw the map. Mm-hmm. So
was he impressed by the quantity of stars?
Well, I think they were just impressed that it's actually a real map.
They didn't believe us?
Well, we're not making it up. But
it's a real... I'm touching it right now.
People can't see. It's not TV.
That's why I announced that I was touching it.
You described it. I've got my fingers on the wall.
It's plasticky, shiny.
But we really need to get a photo of that up on Facebook.
Okay.
Not that I know how to do that, but Julia certainly does.
Maybe I'll do that with my phone.
Oh, you know how to do it. Are you a friend of mine?
No, but I will befriend you in order to place this photograph on your timeline.
Do I have to do anything?
You don't, no. Julia might, but you don't.
Perfect. It's the way I like it. Okay, so I'm not sure where this gentleman is from. I could really delve deep into this answer. Doesn't sound like it, but trust me, I will try to keep it not as deep.
Okay.
and encourage this person. And I did. I emailed him today to tell him if he wanted to get a hold of me and talk about this, we could. It's four lines. It's a very short email, but he's covering a lot in it. He begins, "I have been looking through your archives." I know.
Well, they're quite extensive now.
Well,
we've been in business now for quite a while. There's a lot of archives.
Yeah, but I think it's set. And that's what I emailed him with an answer. I think it automatically deletes after a year or two.
What?
Yes, because
there's
a
body of knowledge there.
We don't want to broadcast things that no longer applicable. Applicable.
I get it.
Okay. I said it right.
It's sad, though.
Okay.
It's sad. We have all that recording, all those jokes.
But I'm pretty sure, yes, when we had the jokes. So he began, "I have been looking through your archives and was wondering if you can point me to the podcast on life insurance you and Chris did." And I think that was a while ago. Mm-hmm. And he wrote,
"So it might have been purged.
I remember hearing it over the past couple of years, but I don't see it." And I think it was one of them mm-hmm. that got purged.
Probably.
"I am in the process of getting life insurance and trying to decide between term insurance versus a mix of both term and permanent insurance. The permanent insurance would be more of a part of a retirement vehicle. Mm-hmm. Please get back to me when you have a chance. Thanks." So
that's all the detail?
That's all he told me.
We don't know how old he is.
I don't know
we
anything.
Don't know.
None of that.
Oh, this is a wide open question. You could talk for days on this.
Well, I already warned
you
our podcast
all around the West on this one.
Yes, but I won't. So I'm just assuming that I'm going to attack it from 3 points. Number one, he needs insurance, because if you don't need insurance, you wouldn't buy it.
So that's the first question. Do you actually need insurance?
That's the first thing you look on any life insurance. Do you need it?
Well, that's not necessarily how it's sold. Not term. Term is sold if you need insurance, but there's lots of other life insurance products that are sold for a variety
of
reasons.
Well, and that's what he's getting at here. So the first thing I'm going to assume mm-hmm. is he needs insurance. Because that's why you buy term insurance. I'm going to explain in a minute what term is. So I'm assuming when he wrote, he's trying to decide between just term mm-hmm. and term and permanent combined, he needs insurance.
Right. So this is kind of like, this question comes up, this type of question comes up a lot. And it's almost like, do I need the deluxe floor mats and the undercoating on my car? Make sure you've answered the initial question first. Do I need a car? Before you start talking about the fancy stuff that you can bolt onto it. Because there is such thing as a basic car, a.k.a. basic life insurance. Then there's all kinds of fancy accessories that you can put on this thing that may or may not be attractive. I'm not going to cast, you know, a broad brush and ridicule them or support them. But just know there's all kinds of options in the world of life insurance that can spruce up your basic car.
Exactly. And do you need the deluxe version of the car or just a car?
The first question is, and make sure you're not just buying accessories when you don't really need the car in the first place.
So that's the approach I'm going to take. Does he need insurance? I made mm-hmm. the assumption he does.
Yeah. Let's all agree, yes.
Yes. Then I'm going to explain what term coverage is, mm-hmm. some of the things you may want to look for in it. On the permanent side of insurance, I'm going to talk openly about that. And also give my biased opinion, I'll admit, because I don't like using life insurance as a quote-unquote retirement savings vehicle. But he said that's why he's considering permanent. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give him a few pointers that he may want to look for on that. So that's the approach we're going to take on today's show. Mm-hmm. First thing, does he need insurance? He doesn't share anything in here with me. So I just have to assume he does. If you don't, listener, need insurance, then don't go out and buy it. We talk openly that I used to have a boat. When I had the boat, I had boat insurance. I'm 54 years old. I don't have life insurance. You're younger than me, but I'm assuming you have life insurance.
I do.
You have six kids totally dependent on you and a wife mm-hmm. and a couple of dogs and fish and chickens and all these other things. If I pass away, there's nothing, no one rather, dependent on me. Corbett, my dog is, but I got friends who will take care of him.
Right.
Certainly not going to want to buy a life insurance policy for Corbett.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have life insurance because no one suffers an economic loss if I pass away. But when I had a boat, I had boat insurance. I no longer have boat insurance. Why? I don't have a boat.
Mm. Fascinating how that works.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I did buy a new car recently. You know that.
Mm.
And I insured the new car. Why? I have a car. Plus, it's law in Colorado. Let's just assume it wasn't law and I didn't have to have coverage if I didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
I got a car now. I'm going to go out and get car insurance because I have a risk there. So I'm just assuming, listener, you have someone or someone's economically dependent on you living. That if you pass away, they will suffer an economic hardship, probably by a loss of the income you were bringing in, mm-hmm. or that they were dependent on you to provide something. You might sometimes have business owners having life insurance on each other, partners, because if one partner dies, the business may go under, or the surviving partner is going to have a while replacing lost customers or managing the business, and they're going to need an influx of cash. So they may have business insurance that way. Or sometimes to help buy out the survivors or the decedent's family. So one businessman now owns it. It's fine when you have businessman one and two, but if businessman one dies, businessman two doesn't want to run the business now with business one's family.
Right.
So they have life insurance to allow business owner two to buy out the family so he or she owns mm-hmm. the entire place. In other words, there's got to be a need that someone is going to suffer a need that someone will mm-hmm. suffer at your death. So let's just assume he needs life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Then how do you cover that risk? First thing, this show is called the Retirement and IRA Show. It is not called the I Want to Sell You Life Insurance Show. Because if it was, it would be a totally different show.
Yes.
So the first thing I got people to understand when it comes to retirement, dying too soon isn't often the problem. Living too long is. So I often share with my younger clients in their 40s and 50s, you may need life insurance still now, but you may not need it in the future when you get into your 70s, 80s, and 90s. And instead, what your biggest concern at that point is living too long, becoming a burden to your family, needing some type of long-term care coverage, either for dementia or Alzheimer's or simply by aging. And you need someone to come take care of you. And a traditional life insurance policy isn't going to help at that point. So you have to look at the risk. There becomes a point in someone's life, Chris, where that risk turns. And it's no longer about dying too soon, but it's living too long.
Right.
So I'm hoping this listener took that all into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
When would you use the two different types of policies he talks about, though? Term and permanent. And that all comes down to the risk and the aim you're trying to mitigate. Term life insurance is when you know this risk is here of you dying too soon, but it's only for a specific period. It may be until your house is paid off, or until your youngest child is through college, or through your entire working career, but you hope to retire at 65. And at that point, when you're retired, you have all the assets you've accumulated, and dying may not necessarily impose any type of economic hardship on someone anymore. So you may not need life insurance. Now, a life insurance agent, if they're listening, they're cringing right now because to them, you need life insurance forever. And it's just this wonderful vehicle that's going to solve all of life's problems, and it's better than sliced bread. But we look at life insurance much more pragmatically. What is the risk? When I had a boat, I had boat insurance. And I personally don't even have life insurance. And we offer it to people. We have helped people buy it. And I tell them freely. People sometimes ask me, what type of policy do you have? Or who do you have your policy with, Jim? And I tell them, I don't have life insurance. I don't have boat insurance. I don't have life insurance. I don't have a boat, and I don't have anyone dependent on me. And I have more than enough equity built in my house. There's no debts I owe. I'm not passing away. Even if I did have debts, Chris, no one's on the hook for them. No one co-signed on my loans. Nobody, it's just, there's nothing. I'm a single man with no children, no dependents, no wife, no ex.
That you know of.
That I know of. Well, no, I'd know if I had an ex.
Well, you have plenty of exes.
Oh, you mean kids? No, I don't have kids.
I'm talking about kids.
No, if there was some little junior Jim running around, I'm sure the wife would have let me know by now. Not the wife, the mother.
Well, you never know.
Yeah, well, if there is a child out there who's mine...
Just know he has no life insurance.
I have no life insurance, so don't kill me. So let's look at, when do you decide to use term? When do you decide to use permanent? Permanent insurance should be used if there is a permanent risk that someone will suffer a financial hardship at your death, and that is going to remain forever. Most permanent policies that I have ever sold in my career have been in special needs situations.
A special needs child. Mm-hmm. So you've got hopefully a case where you, the parent, is going to pass before the child. But the child needs lifetime care. Traditional situations, when the children reach a certain age, they're kind of off on their own. So when you pass, everyone is sad, but they aren't financially dependent upon you anymore. But special needs children, very different. And that is absolutely a case where permanent insurance is should be considered as part of your overall plan.
And permanent insurance, by its very nature, sounds like it's going to last forever. But as I hopefully will share in a few minutes, that's not often the case. An insurance that is sold as quote-unquote permanent is nothing even close to being permanent, and you often are being forced to pump in more premiums as you age, and even though they can't cancel the policy on you because you're getting older, the premiums can rise because the premiums aren't guaranteed. People weren't paying attention to guarantees. They're looking at the non-guaranteed illustrations, and people run into huge problems. So even though insurance might be called permanent, it sometimes isn't. But a term policy on no uncertain terms, no pun intended, is going to provide coverage for the length you specify, the term you specify.
As long as the premiums are paid.
As long as the premiums are paid. Mm-hmm. Normally, they're sold in 5-year blocks, but that's not etched in stone. You can get a 22-year term if you really looked hard enough. But most of the time, they're sold in 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, and 30-year blocks. Mm-hmm. A term policy is designed to provide protection just during that period. And the idea is to buy a policy long enough to cover that risk. And if it's not a special needs child situation where you have to make sure there's money available, and there's other reasons besides special needs for permanent insurance or permanent like right. insurance. And I've seen it before if people want to guarantee an inheritance. I want to make sure my church gets this money. I want to make sure my child gets this money. It's out there. Years ago, when estate taxes were an issue, remember, years ago, estate taxes kicked in after $600,000 mm-hmm. of assets. And that was sucking in middle-class people into this issue. And they were being faced with leaving a tax burden or losing a lot of their estate to taxes. So they would buy permanent life insurance designed to provide liquidity to the estate to pay taxes so their inheritors, usually their children, wouldn't be faced with having to liquidate something within 9 months of death to pay estate taxes. Now, that's a much smaller situation. Now they've changed the estate tax rules, as Pete said, and hopefully he'll be coming on shortly. Less than, what did he say, 0.7% of people now pay the estate tax. So it's just, or is it 0.3%? I think he said.
I think it's 0.3.
Yeah, it's just a small sliver of American society that has that much in assets where they have to worry about the estate tax. Those people, though, may have permanent insurance. Mm-hmm. not for special needs child situation, but because of the estate tax issue.
So there are a variety of reasons why permanent life insurance makes sense. You've got a permanent risk exposure. But in other cases where there's not, we generally do not recommend a life insurance type product unless you truly need permanent style.
Well, he freely admits in his email he's considering the permanent, because he wrote the permanent would be more as a part of a retirement vehicle. Mm-hmm. So here he's being sold a bill of goods. That I can tell you. Either that or he's a do-it-yourselfer who's read a few articles, probably more insurance-driven articles, right, trying to talk about these permanent policies as a viable option because you can access your money tax-free. The growth in the policy can be accessed tax-free via a policy loan. And that is rife with so much that can go wrong, it makes me cringe. And he has to be very careful on that. I have been a practicing retirement planner for 17 years, and I'm proud to say I have never sold a quote-unquote permanent insurance policy as a retirement vehicle. Is that to say no one could ever benefit from it? If you fully maxed out your 401ks, fully maxed out a defined benefit plan, fully maxed out your IRAs, and any other type of qualified plan you may be eligible to participate in, and you still have so much money, you got to shove that somewhere. And you've looked at your future tax liability, and it's going to be so high, you have no choice but to access it through a tax-free loan from life insurance. Maybe that policy would be okay for you. But so few people, Chris, fall into that. Mm-hmm. This ability to borrow from the policy is used more as an illustrated ploy to sell you something you don't need, because that policy is going to commission the agent selling it 10 times more what a term policy is going to commission that agent for selling it. An incredible amount of more commission is driven on these permanent policies. Why? The insurance company makes a killing off of them. The ability to borrow from them is so rife with issues that no one is explaining to people. The policies could lapse. You could lapse with an outstanding loan. The loan is not free. You've got to pay interest. Now, you pay that interest to the insurance company. You're not paying it to yourself. There are so many other...
Yeah, so that's unlike some people have heard of borrowing from your 401k, and you do pay interest on those loans. You're required by law to pay interest on those loans, but people oftentimes point out, well, yes, but I'm paying interest to myself. There's some tax issues related to that, which are beyond the scope of this show, but I am paying interest that goes right back in my 401k for these loans from supposedly your policy that you're taking out. The interest payments that you've got there aren't just going to back to fill up the policy.
No.
Right? They're going to go to the insurance company.
So I'm getting a little ahead of myself. We'll get back into that in a minute. Back to the term part. I'm assuming because he said he's considering either term or term with permanent, and the permanent is only to fund his retirement, he does need insurance, and he knows the exact length of time or an approximate length of time he needs the coverage for. So now he has to look at term. Let's look at term policies first. Term policies are fairly straightforward, listeners. You're going to buy them for the length of time you need. I often recommend you go a little bit beyond. Mm-hmm. If you think you're going to need it for 22 years, don't buy a 20-year term, because after 20 years, the policy goes away. Granted, it renews annually at that point in time. So really, the way these policies work, for the first 20 years, the policy's premiums are levelized. Year 21, look at your insurance illustration when you get them. They go through the roof.
Yeah. Well, it's because the only people who would keep it are people that are on the verge of dying.
And need it.
And they know that, so they're going to charge out the nose for
premiums.
And, yeah,
the premiums are so high to drive you out, so you don't renew it.
Right.
But at that point, it generally becomes what is known as annual renewable terms. And as long as you pay the premium every year, and they are outrageously high, that quote-unquote term policy would continue. But again, the premiums are just so astronomical. No one ever does. Don't believe me? Look at the insurance illustration, and you can see how high those premiums would go on a quote-unquote term policy. So you just really utilize term. So if you have a 22-year need, a 20-year policy won't be enough. I would get a 25-year policy. But if you need a 20-year, I would look at the pricing difference between a 20 and a 25-year. And if you can afford it, you might want to buy a slightly longer one just in case you decide to keep working a few more years or the issue isn't quite gone. You don't have to keep the policy.
Right,
you're under no obligation. But yes, if you buy a 25-year policy, not a 20-year policy, your premiums will be a little bit higher. And even though you can get policies, term policies of varying lengths, they don't have to be sold in five-year increments. The vast majority of them are sold in five-year increments. So the amount of carriers offering policies outside of that realm are so, there's far fewer. So there's less competition, so premiums are higher. And sometimes a 22 or 23-year policy will cost you more than a 25-year policy because there's much more competition in the 25-year realm. So pay a little bit of attention to that as you choose your term, listener. Just get a term that at least fills the conceivable time period you're going to need that policy's coverage. Now, an insurance agent who wants to sell you a permanent policy and not, in this listener's case, of just for retirement use, but wants to convince you you need a permanent policy in case something happens to you and the risk your beneficiaries could suffer an economic loss at your death, especially if your death caused a financial hardship. In other words, they'll say, well, yeah, you can get a 20-year term or a 30-year term, Mr. and Mrs. Person, Mr. and Mrs. Client, but what if there is a, towards the end of that policy, you suffered dementia and you've caused huge financial hardships to your family and you died the day after this policy matures? Nothing is paid to your family. So they'll play that up as a reason to entice you to get the far more expensive permanent policy. A lot of times what they'll do, because the permanent premiums are so much more, they'll marry this combo approach that this gentleman is talking about. They don't necessarily do it to tell you to use it to fund for retirement like he is, but they'll do it for the very reason I just described. They'll say, you're still going to need that bit of permanent protection in case as this term policy begins to expire, you have this issue that is going to cause an economic hardship. You'll have this permanent. So let's just say you need $1 million of coverage. They may sell you $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 of permanent, and they could never sell you $1 million permanent policy. It'd be so outrageously expensive. They'll then intermarry that permanent policy with a much larger term policy for 20, 25, 30 years, whatever length of time the original insurable need needs to be covered. So they kind of use that as a way of enticing you to buy some permanent coverage, a little bit of permanent coverage. Here's my take on that. BS. What you need to look for is a convertible feature in your term policy. Nearly all term policies are sold with an ability to convert it into a permanent policy. Now, there's a lot of nuances and catches to this. So you got to work with an agent who's going to work with you and not just try to sell you a term policy. That's why I'm very hesitant to tell people to go onto these websites and type in just the information you need and buy the lowest price term policy. They'll look at that as if term is a commodity. Technically, it is. As long as you buy from the same rated carriers, A+, A++ carriers, does it really matter what carrier you get it from? So people look at price. Well, here's a 20-year term, Chris, that's going to cost me $1,500 a year. Here's another 20-year term that's going to cost me $1,800 a year. I'm going to go with the $1,500. Both carriers are A-rated carriers. I'm just making this all up. So you think, well, they got to be the same. Convertibility feature is one of the big features where term policies can compete against each other. and you need to evaluate a few things. So what is convertibility? Convertibility is where you can call up the insurance company without providing any proof of insurance. In other words, you don't have to go through underwriting again. They will sell you or allow you to take a policy that would have expired at the end of the term and turn it into a permanent policy. Now, there's some caveats to that. They'll still use the underwriting you originally got on most. Some may say they're going to use a different rating, but most will use whatever your rating was when you bought it. But it's going to be age specific. So if you originally bought it at 40 and now you're 65, and let's just say it's convertible to age 70, so you're still within the conversion window, you get diagnosed with a disease and you think, I want to keep this policy permanent. And if you were originally rated preferred, they'll allow you to convert it into a permanent policy with a preferred rating, but at a 65-year-old's premium, not a 40-year-old's premium. So it will be premium specific based on age. Now, all this sounds, wow, that's pretty cool. There's a lot of caveats to this. And oftentimes, if convertibility is important to you, you have to find out a few things about that about that term policy's conversion feature. Have you ever heard of conversion features before?
Yes, I have. I'll admit I have a convertible term policy that could convert to permanent insurance during its term.
Perfect. So some of the nuances you have to look for, first of all, is it a promise or a contractual agreement? That is hugely important. It could be a right now, because I've heard wholesalers describe it to me this way. Right now, they offer a conversion feature on that policy. Oh, right now. Some policies can be changed later. Now, they can't just pick on you and say, hey, we decided anyone named Christine living in Colorado can't convert. But they could decide someday, you know, we're not going to allow conversion. We years ago, we offered it, but we don't offer convertibility anymore. Contractual conversion, it's in the contract. Mm-hmm. They have to allow it. Same thing into what type of policy can you convert it into? Some offer just one type of policy that is oftentimes just a policy available only to people who are converting, and it is such a high-priced, poor-performing, low-value, permanent-style policy. In other words, it's not their top-of-the-line good policy. It's just a really junky permanent policy. Because, folks, when you buy a permanent policy, unlike a term, permanent policies are structured. They're created. They're illustrated. You talk to the insurance company. Often when I'm buying a permanent policy for a client, Chris, I will talk to the underwriter, not the underwriters, but the policy creation people either at the mutual companies directly or through my insurance wholesaler, and they'll ask, you know, what is the condition of your client? What are they looking to do? What type of cash value are they looking for? Minimal or a lot of cash value? Things of that nature. Well, this permanent policy, we can structure and design it this way. This permanent policy, we have flexible premiums. They can increase them. They can decrease them. They can do all these different things. So permanent policies, you have much more flexibility when you create them. But a lot of term policies, when they'll say, oh, they're convertible, it'll be into a policy with very little options. Other carriers allow whatever term policies are around at the time you convert. And that's saying, we don't know what's coming in the future, but anything in our future offerings, you can convert into. You can look through all the different types of term policies we offer and choose the one that's appropriate for you. So again, it doesn't necessarily mean the lower priced policies offer the least flexible conversion provisions, but you really have to look, is this a promise or is this contractual? It may be contractual that you can convert, and the promise is anything that's available, but that part is subject to change. So you have to also look at that aspect of it. Where do I talk to clients about convertibility? when clients are unsure. Sometimes it comes back to special needs situations, Chris. And it's not that the child is in a wheelchair-style special needs. They may say, you know, right now, my son or my daughter, they're 22. They seem to be going through this real difficult stage. They're not studying in school. I think they're a spendthrift. They're in a bad relationship. I'm just worried about them. I want to make sure there's money there. But I'm hoping that they can come out of this as time goes on. So maybe they don't need the permanent policy right away, Chris, and the very high premiums. So I talk openly to them. Why don't we cover this with a 10, 15, 20-year term, save substantially on premiums, but let's look at carriers with really good conversion abilities. Now, granted, if you convert this, you will have to pay higher premiums because they're going to be based on your attained age, not the age you bought it at. But at least you have a decision that you can wait 10, 15, 20 years to give the child a chance to straighten their act out before you convert it. Does that part make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a way to try to keep the client's cost of insurance low now because they're unsure if they need to convert it later. Same thing in retirement planning. And I'm not talking about retirement planning in a sense that he wants to build, I'm assuming, cash value and borrow from it, but sometimes people are unsure what their retirement situation is going to be, if one spouse would suffer an economic loss at the death of the other spouse or not. But they might be in their 40s or early 50s in need of coverage, but they don't feel they need permanent coverage throughout their retirement, but they're not sure. But the cost of buying a permanent policy is so much more. They just want a little bit of flexibility. So you have to look at these conversion features. If it's contractual, if it's a promise, and that's number one. Number two, is it convertible with full flexibility into any offering or only a specific offering? And on that, Chris, is that contractual as well, or is it just a promise? It could be a contractual policy. You can convert this. With a promise, any available policy. But promises can be broken. Contractual can't. So you really have to kind of look at some of this. And the final thing, how long can you convert for? Some will say convertible up to age 70. Some might be age 65. Some might be within 5 years of the maturity of the policy. So a 30-year policy could be converted for the first 25 years, but you have to continue reading the fine print. Is it up to a certain age? So you really have to know when can you convert it. Not that it is convertible. What are the conversion limits by age and by policy length? You have to look at both of those. Some might say convertible up to 70 or 5 years before policy matures. And what the ones with that provision, whether it's 3 years, 5 years, 10 years before, I've never seen one as 10 years. Most of the ones I've seen are within 5 years. They don't want you to wait to the very last year to see. They want you to convert, you know, they're worried about that this person's going to wait to the very last minute. So you have to really look at a lot of that term pot. All too often, term insurance is sold as a commodity, cheapest price. That's not the convertibility to me is very, very important. And you got to understand, is it something that's important to you or not? And is it a promise or in the industry, it doesn't use, I use the word promise. It's called a practice. Our practice right now is to allow convertibility. Or our practice right now is to honor the contractual obligation of us to convert into any policy we offer. That's our practice right now. The practices or promises can be changed. Contractual can't. So you really got to know of this convertibility, how much is a practice or a promise, and how much is contractual. Did I explain that? Okay,
that's good. I think that's a feature of term insurance that not many people understand or value. So, yeah, That was, I think that was good to talk about that.
So as he evaluates term, he needs to evaluate his future risk. If, again, it's a set term, Jim, I've got no risks. I just wanted this money until my mortgage was paid off. Or I wanted this money until my youngest child is done with college. It's a set, pretty much no more further risks. Convertibility isn't important. He may want to look at term as a commodity. Cheapest provider in the same ratings class. You have to really look at that. You don't want a, you know, an A++ company may charge more than a B- company, but the A++ company is going to be around. However, if you're unsure, I don't think I need permanent right now, but you never know. I might want to take a single life pension instead of a joint life pension and be able to buy life insurance for the difference. You know, that's kind of a retirement planning scenario we look at. Well, maybe a convertibility is important to you. Or maybe, again, more often than not, when I have looked at convertibility for clients and paid some attention to these different things I described, it has to do with children. They're not special needs in the traditional sense where they have a legitimate, I don't want to say legitimate by downplaying other disabilities, but they have a real definable disability. Yes, my child has Down syndrome. Yes, my child is in a wheelchair. We often see it with clients who have children that are just making bad decisions right now. And the clients or the people I'm working with feel confident that the children are going to work it through, but they don't know. And they're just, gee, I don't know if I want permanent or not. But the premium difference, Chris, on permanent can be 3 to 10 times more per year. So it scares people away. And what they end up doing is buying too little insurance because they can't afford the permanent premiums. Well, maybe the convertibility feature is better. But granted, the big risk there is if you do need it, you have to convert at a much higher age, and now the premiums may totally be unaffordable. So I get it. You got to weigh the two. You buy them now, they're higher than term, but lower than what you would pay when you convert. Does that part make sense?
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Okay. So that's all I wanted to talk about on the term policy. The only other thing before we wrap up today's show is to look at him wanting to use this as a retirement savings vehicle. Listener, be very, very careful on that. That's all I can say. Chances are he's probably being sold a universal product. It won't be a GUL, my favorite type of permanent coverage, guaranteed universal life. I like it because it doesn't grow cash value. There's nothing you can borrow from it. It is the cheapest form of quote-unquote permanent insurance, you can get. Because literally you choose the age up to 121 you want it to go for. So you want a flexible term policy and you need it for 37 years? Just add 37 to your age and buy a GUL good to that age. It's that easy. And as long as you pay your premium on time, that's the key with a GUL. You as late as one day on a GUL premium, I say it blows it up. It doesn't. They can't. Well, they could theoretically cancel it after the grace period, which is usually 30 days. The premiums will change. The premiums are guaranteed as long as you pay them on time every year for that specified period of years. You miss by one day, the premium's going to change. I'm not saying it's going to go through the roof, but the premium's going to change. That's right in the contract. Insurance company's got you. Oop, you're late. Premium change. Here's your new premium. And as long as you pay that on time, everything's okay. So we tell our clients with a GUL, don't be late. We actually contact every client with a GUL 30 days before the premium is due to remind them to pay the premium. Okay. I'm guessing he's talking about an indexed universal life policy. They used to be VULs, variable universal life policies, all through the 80s and 90s. Those were the king of the hill.
Yep.
Those were the ones that were sold repeatedly. The 2000s came, and VULs were blowing up left and right. The lawsuits were flying, the VULs were blowing up, nothing was working, so the industry came out with IULs. Indexed universal life. These policies are sold on the premise that you can, quote unquote, participate, usually in the S&P 500, some index. You're going to be able to participate in this index. You're going to be able to capture 10, 15% upside. So in other words, if the S&P is up 10 or 12 or 13%, you get 100% of that return. It can never drop. It can never go down, your index participation. And they show you these illustrations, Chris, that make these things look so beautiful. Everything is smooth. Everything is gorgeous. Okay, take all that and shove it. Because what they're not telling you is the ugly truth on IULs. First of all, these are indexed products. How do they actually figure? You look at the illustration on these, Chris. It's all a nice, steady. Oh, let's just assume you average 6%. And they show you 6% every year.
Every year, yep.
Every year. Beautiful, isn't it? And there's a cap rate on this. Well, a couple of things. Cap rates can be changed by the insurance company. Cost of insurance on these policies can be changed anytime the insurance company wants. So the only guarantee on it, they'll tell you the minimum cap rate it can go to. It's usually 3%. So they'll say, yeah, it's got a 13% cap rate. What he's not telling you is it can go down to 3. If the policy was issued at 6 and the cap rate drops to 3, what do you think that's going to do to the policy? If it's being illustrated at a certain rate of return, your policy has to get that rate of return or you have to put more premiums in. The other thing is they're usually illustrated at what they call current charges. Not what the policy can raise the cost of insurance to, Chris, but just what they're charging you now based on current charges. What they don't tell you, they being the insurance salesman, is that these quote-unquote current charges can go up. You want to truly see what your policy is going to do, ask your agent to illustrate it with max charges and lowest cap rate. Because that's the worst case scenario on mm-hmm. that policy. And look at what that policy will look like. And it ain't going to be pretty.
No.
And if you truly need permanent coverage, something that might have been sold to you, because with an IUL, you can do the same thing. You can pick an age, how long you want this policy to go for. So you might choose age 100 or 105 or 110, 120. And if the agent used a 6 or 7% average return that this thing is going to return, you know, everything, life is beautiful and it appears to be growing. Ask him to stress it. Show me what would happen if I don't get 7, if I only get 5. And show me what would happen not at current charges, but at max charges. And ask him to see the annualized. They'll show you what you're going to be paying every year in cost of insurance. An IUL, Chris, unlike a GUL or a whole life policy, that attempts to take the premiums, just like on a term policy, and guarantee them level for a certain period of time. On a whole life policy, it's usually to age 100. On a GUL, it's usually to 121, the longest, or you can choose a shorter time period. And a lot of whole life policies now also go to 120. They attempt to take the premiums and levelize them. On these IULs, there's no such guarantee on that. Your premiums go up every year. Not your premiums. Let me rephrase that. Your cost of insurance goes up. And you can see that in the schedule. And you ask to see that fee schedule, the cost of insurance schedule. You'll see how much the insurance goes up every year. And that can change. The cost of insurance on those policies can change. Whereas the cost of insurance on a GUL or a whole life is kind of set. I say kind of because there's some nuances to it, but kind of set at the time you buy it. And as long as you pay your premium on time, remember what I told you on the GUL, though, you're just one day late, they're going to change it. But as long as you pay your premiums on time, they can't raise it later, Chris. They can't raise your premiums. But on an IUL, your premiums can change. It can change if the cost of insurance goes up. It can change if the cap rates go down. It can change if the policy doesn't average what you thought it was. And it can change, Chris, if you borrow from it. So here we have a man who may want to open one of these policies to grow cash value, to borrow from it. Well, the illustrations often don't factor in loans. And they assume the cash value is going to grow at these rates. Well, as soon as you start borrowing from it, or worse, take a withdrawal from it, it can blow the policy up. And if the policy lapses, any outstanding loan might become taxable to you. Even though you don't get the money, it's an outstanding loan, you will owe taxes on that. Gets a little nuanced on how the tax policies work. But I'm encouraging our listener to talk to your agent. What happens if I have outstanding loans and I can't afford the policy anymore? Let him explain to you what happens. So I don't want to get too deep in the nuances of this policy, but I'm very cautious on these indexed policies because they are sold under these very high, quote-unquote, cap rates, where it makes it look like you're going to be able to enjoy a tremendous amount of the return of an index, usually the S&P. But the reality is those cap rates can change. And also, in the past, before the insurance commissioners passed a rule a couple of years ago called AG 49, and that was to rein in index universal life because they were being run with these outrageous projections, 10, 11, 12%, just like they were under VULs in the 80s and 90s. By law back then, the highest rate of return on a variable universal life policy was 12%. So the higher the rate of return you project, the lower amount of money you have to put in, or the more massive amount of cash value it looks like you're going to grow. So agents were illustrating 12%, not because it was realistic, but because that was the maximum amount. They started doing the same thing with IULs. Now, IULs, as anyone would tell you if they got half a brain or they're honest, the cap rate, Chris, doesn't include what? Just like on a indexed annuity, you get the price change of the market, but you don't get what?
No dividends.
No dividends. And that is crucial because I got this from Wealth Management Magazine. I had to go back and reference. It's called The True Meaning of the S&P 500 Index. And he's talking about indexing and the importance that dividends play. Mm-hmm. When you buy an indexed annuity, your cap rates are very low, 3, 4, 5%, and they're treating it more as a bond. But on an indexed universal life policy, they're showing you outrageously high cap rates. And this guy's just trying to tear that apart in his article. And he goes on to say that there's periods of time where dividends have returned the lion's share of it, and he talked about 1970 to 1980, 66% of the return of the S&P, according to this gentleman, in that time period,
came from dividends. Yep. So if you weren't receiving those,
you don't get them.
You don't get them. And so your actual performance is going to look way different than what the estimate was.
And then he talks about these high cap rates. And he says, January of 2000 to December 31st, 2016, a 17-year return. The S&P 500 returned with dividends 4.75%. So there is a 17-year period. Now, he freely concedes. You could find other cherry-picked periods of time where the market's done really well. But the point is, what period of time are you entering as you buy this? His quote on these illustrations. I love what he calls this illustration. And of course, now I'm trying to find it and I'm not going to be. Oh, here's what he says about the illustrations on these IULs. What's being used, he's talking about the illustrations. What's being used is a sales tool that's only capable of showing something that is statistically impossible. There is no variability in those returns, no sequence being factored into those returns. It is telling you, and oftentimes the agent says, look at what the market has done. You're going to be able to get 13% of that. And if the market's ever down, your cash value doesn't drop. It just stays there. But this isn't the market. What he's trying to tell you is you're not in the market. You're in you're indexed to the market. You're not in the market, so you get no dividends. And as he pointed out, there's periods of time where dividends were a huge return. His claim, and I haven't proofed any of his numbers, and in his article he doesn't say, hey, I use this software, I use these numbers, but he claims during any measured time period, dividends account for 20 to 40% of the returns in the S&P itself. So he's saying 20 to 40% in any time period he examined, dividends made up, in any time period, dividends made up 20 to 40%, with the long, the most onerous time period to dividends was 70 to 80, 1970, 1980, 66%. Did I explain that part right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to get people to understand, when you look at these through an indexed annuity and they're only promising you 3, 4, 5%, that's totally, I hate to say achievable, but it's doable in an index product, not counting dividends. But when you're trying to rely on a projection, Chris, that's using a 5, 6, 7% rate of return, his point is you're probably not going to get it. And the illustration is really just a sales tool to get you to buy something that's spouting an impossibility. And he doesn't feel these are being sold honestly. And I tend to agree with him. The name of this man, I don't have it here. I really love his readings. He is a, God, he knows as much about life insurance as I do IRAs. I don't have his name here. I'd give it to you. Great articles this man runs writes. He's a very good writer. His whole business is life insurance analysis for very high net worth people. Mm-hmm. He's not going to work with you on a $500,000 permanent. I guess he would, but you wouldn't want to pay him his fee. He works with a lot of Fortune 500, very high up people designing massive policies. But this person knows insurance, so I really value what he writes. I apologize to our listeners. We don't have his name. I'll get it on another show. And read a lot. Just Google his name and read his blog. Very good articles. But his whole point on this is you got to be careful on these IULs. They're not all they're cracked up to be. The cash value isn't going to increase as much. And then even if it did and you start borrowing from it or withdrawing from it, it can blow the policy up. So that's one reason I don't use them. And most agents selling these IULs, they don't understand them, Chris. And they're just showing these illustrations. And these AG 49 rules that the NAIC, National Association of Insurance Commissioners, passed, and all 50 states adopted it. Insurance is regulated at the state level, not the federal level. The NAIC is just all 50 insurance state regulators formed their own parent organization. Mm-hmm. And they were so irate before they passed this rule in 2015, at the rates of return being illustrated in these IULs, they cracked down on it. Now they have to use roughly between 5 and 7%. It's actually going to be based on the type of policy, your age, your underwriting, and a few other variables that are put in that the most the insurance agent can illustrate is locked in by government regulations now. And in the article that I got those numbers from that I referenced to you, he talked about a big policy he was analyzing. Someone hired him to analyze a policy he already owned. And he said the AG 49 rate used in the illustration, I want to get the exact number correct. I think it was 6.28. Yeah, 6.28%. But as he pointed out, that carrier used 6.28%, not because it was the most realistic projection under the AG 49 rules. That came to the max that could be illustrated. So the company and the agent illustrated the max, not the most realistic. And that's the thing you have to really be careful with on these. And he put in big letters one of the biggest problems with this, which we talk about right here under other considerations. What does he write? And we talk about it all the time with retirement planning.
Sequential risk, the sequence of returns, which is completely being ignored in these illustrations. They just
Absolutely.
Use a flat rate of return every
Exactly.
single year, which is ultimately very different circumstances than variable returns, which, as we all know, is what really happens in the markets.
So you have a situation where the person selling these policies are going to tell you your cash value will never drop. If the market is down, you just get zero. It sounds beautiful, doesn't it? But if your illustration, remember the illustration that he was using came to 6.28%. So if you were assuming 6.28% every year and you get a zero in there, now you can, 6.28% ain't going to be enough. You now have to get more. And even, what if the next year you only got four? And then the next year another zero. Now you're 3 years into this.
And you're way off track.
Where you were going to be almost 19% up. And you're barely up three. It blows, it doesn't blow the policy up. You got to put more money in.
Mm-hmm.
So your premiums go up, or the amount of cash value you thought you were going to have is now not there. And these policies, nothing is guaranteed. The only thing that's guaranteed on an IUL is the lowest the cap rate can go. The cost of insurance can change. How high the cap rate can go can change. Remember, they'll give you a minimum cap rate of 2, 3%. They can't go below that. But any year, they can change the cost of your insurance. They can change what your cap rate is. It could be 13% the first year, 6% the next. Now, I've never seen a drop that serious, but I'm just giving this as an example. The whole provisions of these policies, the fees, the interest rates, can all change. Not only just your cost of insurance, but the overhead cost to the insurance companies can change. If you really understood how little is guaranteed in these IULs, you'd probably wonder, why the hell would I want to buy this? So that's just my sharing. To me, there are much better ways to grow a account you can use for retirement. And the ability to borrow from it tax-free, to me, is overrated. If you really understand how taxation works, it's truly overrated. And you're only borrowing, Chris. You got to pay interest on it. So what's more valuable to you? Tax-free income where you might be able to... We talk all the time in retirement. You can sometimes manipulate, especially during the tax planning window, your income. And if you could stay in the 15% tax bracket, you could have a 0% cap gains rate. So, you know, buy term, invest the rest is something that's bantered about all the time. Pay these low term premiums, invest your money, and during your window, manipulate your income and realize your cap gain at that time tax-free.
Yep.
There's your tax-free income. Or max out a Roth 401k at work or your own Roth IRA. There's other ways to get tax-free income. And taxable income isn't all bad, Chris. Not that anybody likes paying tax, but yes, free is better than a tax rate. But you can really manipulate your income sometimes and keep your tax bracket low.
Quite low.
And get some tax-free income out. Anyways, I've personally never have sold these. I'm not against permanent insurance like Dave Ramsey is. I cringe every time that guy says there's never a good reason to buy permanent insurance. I guess he's never had a listener with a special needs child. I disagree vehemently. There are certain times where you need that permanent protection. It's usually special needs situations. Or you want to guarantee an inheritance. But I don't do it with an IUL. And I don't try to grow cash value and tell clients you can borrow from it tax-free in retirement. It is a wonderful way to sell you insurance you don't need that commissions a hell of a lot of money to the man or woman trying to sell it to you. That's all I have to say.
Yep. Well, that was a good question. We got into some things. We made a few assumptions on there, but we're able to talk about lots of the pros and cons or characteristics of term insurance versus permanent insurance, at least the most popular type of permanent insurance sold now. These IULs are kind of the hot thing has been for the past several years. So if you have any questions like this, please feel free to send us an email, jim@jimhelps.com, and we'll get to that as soon as possible. Can't guarantee we'll turn them around quite as quickly as this. Sometimes it kind of goes in waves. We'll have just a few, and then we'll get a whole bunch all at the same time, and we'll spread them out.
But, I had nothing else to talk about today.
Yeah, no, it's good that we had these. So we'd love your email questions. And so I can't even tell you what the topic will be for next week's show. It'll just depend on what we get.
And again, to our iTunians, this new podcast is evolving. We appreciate your listening to us, and hopefully you found the information valuable. And look forward, hopefully, by the first week, well, maybe the second weekend in October, because yours truly may be out elk hunting, for our new live show. And be ready to call in every Monday, 2 o'clock Mountain Time, as Chris and I record this live over the internet. Talk to us and have your questions answered.
Perfect. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier and Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.